Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's the week of Friday, December 3rd. I'm your fill-in host for the week, Brianne Doyle. The top stories of this week include the Liberal government's ban on conversion therapy finally passing the House with unanimous consent, both Justin Trudeau and Doug Ford receiving failing grades on their environmental policy, and Syrian refugees need Canada to act. Has it forgotten them? Rabble breaks down the news of the day from a progressive lens. It's a good place to catch up and catch on to what's happening in Canadian politics, activism, environment, and so much more. Listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We catch you up on the news of the week and take you further into the stories that matter to you. This week on the show, we're bringing you a segment of our monthly live politics panel, Off the Hill. This month, the theme is Games of the Throne. Libby Davies and Robin Brown host guests MP Leah Gazan, poet and scholar Elle Jones, Indigenous activist and writer Clayton Thomas Mueller, and Rabble's own national senior politics reporter Carl Nirenberg. Parliament is back, and our guests unpack the speech from the throne and what that means for activists. If you can believe it, this is our final show of 2021, and our panel looks back at the year that was and takes a look forward into the new year. Take a listen.
Last week, we heard the speech from the throne, and some of you may wonder why we called this month's panel Games of the Throne. It isn't just a cute take on the popular TV series, but I guess a bit of a poke at the antics that can unfold as the first confidence motion faces the government, particularly in a minority parliament. While always infamously general speeches from the throne, and to quote Carl Nirenberg's recent column, quote, empty of real meaning, nevertheless, a speech from the throne is an initial framing from the government of its agenda. And I think, you know, it's often more about what is not in the speech than what is that is of significant note. So I think we'll begin with you, Leah, because you were there, you took it all in. What was your takeaway from the speech from the throne and why?
Well, you know, I have to say, I agree with Carl. I think it was missing a lot of things, including things that certainly the NDP had pushed for, a wealth tax, you know, something that is really critical. Who's going to pay for the pandemic? Well, we know who now. You know, currently there are seniors in my riding being cut off GIS because they're utilizing the CRB and CERB income as part of income. They're now losing their GIS. The same thing is happening to families who are getting cut off the child tax benefit, and it seems like people continue to pay for it while this government continues to invest in pipelines, invest in fighter jets, where they're looking at, you know, investing in warships. Meanwhile, people are really struggling. Inflation is growing. We know that. But the cost of the inflation cannot be on the backs of the people and our environment.
Yeah. And were you surprised, Leah, that there was so little of substance in terms of the climate emergency? Like there was no reference really to COP26, to what the government plans to do. I mean, it was really quite vacuous.
Well, I actually wasn't surprised. And actually, we are doing, doing the worst out of, you know, all G7 countries. I mean, we have shown where our priorities are, you know, TMX pipeline, LNG, all of this investment in fossil fuels, little or no investment in a just transition. Workers are not doing well. There is no discussions about things like a JLBI, a guaranteed livable basic income, to assist people in even having the choice to support and move out of a just transition. I think it's the same old, and without being hyper-partisan, I think our, you know, all parties have to be on board with bold climate action. We are in a climate crisis. We see that out in BC. right now. We see that out east. We need, I'm disappointed that we don't have a budget that shows a clear commitment to taking bold actions against the climate emergency and taking bold actions to make sure that people can thrive, not just survive, and that life doesn't get harder for families and individuals in Canada.
Over to you, Robin.
Thanks, Lou. Let's go to Elle. Elle, again, welcome to our panel. In a recent article, you noted the importance of organizing at the grassroots, like outside the system for serious change. Did you hear anything at all convincing in the throne speech regarding the government's commitment to ending systemic racism in general and anti-Black racism in particular? And how should grassroots organizers respond to what was in the speech?
Okay, so I'll take this a little bit at a time. The word Black, as referenced to us, only appears in this speech once. We appear as though summoned by the mention of justice, because it's always imagined that there's only certain issues that are Black issues. So even though we're talking about things like pandemic recovery, you know, all kinds of issues, the environment affects Black people, of course, environmental racism particularly impacts Indigenous and Black communities, but there's no specific mention. And then the minute you say justice, here come Black people. But of course, there's nothing substantial around that. In fact, justice reform gets a whole sentence in the speech, and it just says we will continue to work on justice reform. Of course, it's not clear what has even happened on justice reform. We did get the gesture towards ending mandatory minimums on drug charges, for example, but Crowns and police maintain their prosecution. So we know that, I mean, maintain their discretion. So we know that there will be no changes because white people already don't get convicted and charged on drug offenses. They're almost entirely directed towards Black and Indigenous people at this point. And then later on in the speech, we get a surety that we will continue to be tough on guns and be tougher on guns. And of course, we know the discourse around borders, guns, drugs, and gangs. This is extremely racialized discourse. So what we've actually seen on justice reform is they've gestured towards white people essentially and said, don't worry, your child won't go to jail if they're caught with drugs. But then they're like, don't worry though, guns, we're still gonna prosecute these Black people. And she talks about gun violence in our major cities, except the biggest gun crime in Canada in recent years was in Port of Peak, Nova Scotia, a white man who dressed up as a cop and mass shot everybody. So that's not in a major city, and it was a white man. So we're not interested in addressing gun violence when it's, you know, a white man driving around dressed as a cop. But what we're saying is, don't worry, these Black guys in Toronto, essentially, we're going to make sure that we continue to throw them in jail and build prisons. So you cannot, of course, have any kind of justice reform while you maintain anti-Black ideas around who's a criminal, around the idea of harsh policing and punishment. And of course, this kind of pandering to the tough on crime crowd, like, God forbid, should we actually just say that we need to defund the police, we need to stop investing in punishment, we need to start investing in things like the environment, COVID recovery, housing, childcare, mental health treatment, and we don't see any of those specifics. So in terms of Black people, we, as usual, remain almost entirely absented from these speeches as though we do not exist. Although I suppose existing doesn't do you much either, because Indigenous people get mentioned. It's no better. Like, if you're mentioned, then you're just mentioned performatively and you still don't get anything. So we don't see anything substantive in this. Beyond that, in terms of grassroots change, I think the justice issue is a really good one to use as an example. In 2020, in both the Black and Indigenous communities across Canada, we were out in the streets in force to protest, obviously first in the wake of George Floyd, but particularly not just in response to something in the US, but specifically in the response to a number of killings of Indigenous people across this country. I think there was like three killings in 1 week, including a 16-year-old child, Aisha Hudson in Winnipeg. You know, the Regis Korchinski Paquette. We had so many deaths all at once, and people in Canada were coming out specifically to say that this is an issue in Canada. And we had a mass movement. And what have we got from it? We got exactly a drug bill that doesn't properly decriminalize drugs. We can't even get full decrim in this country, even though other countries have it. We're still building more prisons. And what we've got is a few more faces around the table and money for entrepreneurship funds that have nothing to do with what we were actually putting our bodies on the line for. And today we have people being criminalized for fighting encampments, clearance for the unhoused people. Six Black youth were just arrested in Hamilton. We have, of course, people out in Wet'suwet'en not only getting arrested on their ancestral lands, but Indigenous people who came from across Canada being arrested simply for being on the territory, being placed in dog cages, essentially, and paraded in court in their underwear. And many of those people are, of course, fighting things like a housing tract being placed on your own reserve in Six Nations. So on and on and on, we've actually seen an intensification of the criminalization of our peoples across this land, an intensification of building jails and prisons, an intensification of funding the police. In fact, virtually every police department got more funds this year. And it shows you that we can't direct our energies towards saying, oh, we just need the government to do this. We just need a Black cop. We just need a Black justice minister. We just need, you know, a bit of more policy. We need wholesale change. And that is what we really have to work to fight for. One last thing I'll say before I end this long answer, but in my defense, it was a complex question. Right before I got on this Zoom, I was talking to some of the guys inside Collins Bay, the Black people who are incarcerated in Collins Bay, which is one of the prisons where many, many Black people are incarcerated. And they were giving me a bit of hell because they're like, you know, like, why don't you get out there and say our stories more? You got to use your clout for us. And I was trying to say that, you know, you got to pick your spots. It's hard and people don't want to listen. So on their behalf, I want to say that there are so many Black men and Indigenous people and women as well, and people that are non-binary and trans. I don't want to pretend it's, you know, a gender binary here, but so many people that are serving unjust sentences, that are serving time for either offenses they did not commit or serving really enhanced sentences. Particularly this happens to Black and Indigenous people. Many, many Black men convicted on things like gun charges and gang charges that are completely bogus. And these are the things we actually need to turn our attention to. We've refused to fight for the people who need it the most, the people who scare us the most, the people with the worst sentences, the people who are the bad people, the people committing the gun violence. Everybody pretends those people don't exist. And if we pretend those people don't exist, we cannot fight for justice in this country, because justice does not belong to some of us. It belongs to all of us. So I will never ride with a throne speech until it talks about Black people doing gun charges, until it dismantles the idea that Black people are the worst criminals, until it advocates for status for all, until it advocates for sovereignty of Indigenous land and respect for Indigenous territory. Like, until we hear those things, there is absolutely nothing that anybody can really say that is helpful to us. And we will continue to organize outside the system for liberation. So that's my long rant. Thank you, Robin.
No, thank you. Thank you. And actually, just before it passes to Libby, you made a comment about police budgets. So just a report from Ottawa. So after a year of public advocacy here, telling the Ottawa Police Services Board to freeze the budget, they gave the police force an extra $11 million. So over to you, Libby.
Okay. Well, Elle, I sure wish you could have written the speech from the throne. That would have been a barn burner. That was awesome. And I'm now going to turn to Clayton. Clayton, a very special welcome to you because it's your first time on Off the Hill, the political panel. And I wanted to say how much I'm enjoying your new book, Life in the City of Dirty Water. It's an amazing book. Congratulations on your book. And I guess I'll... Yeah. Since our last Off the Hill panel, a lot has happened. COP26 happened, of course, with the usual media hype and subsequent disappointment. We've had the ongoing climate emergency in BC that, of course, Leah referred to, and the violent arrest of Wet'suwet'en land defenders. So, Clayton, what does this say about the government's commitment to address the climate emergency and reconciliation in a meaningful way? What did you read into the speech from the throne? What did you take away from it?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me here this evening. It's such an honor to be on such an incredible panel, Leah and Elle. Like my heart to everything that you have expressed so far. I mean, COP26, you know, Canada, along with governments of the world, you know, have basically committed to a trajectory that will allow for a 2.5 and above even climate degree shift on Mother Earth, which is, you know, is an end game when it comes to small island nations and other, you know, coastal populations all across the planet, as well as, you know, Arctic-based Indigenous peoples, you know, here in these lands that they call Canada, in regards to Wet'suwet'en, you know, I think Indigenous peoples are once again showing that they are doing the hard lifting when it comes to climate action in Canada by standing in the way of dangerous fossil fuel expansion. Their actions deserve solidarity and support, not attacks from militarized police, especially when those police's pension funds are invested in Coastal GasLink and are working for governments who are trying to sell themselves as climate leaders on the world stage. And, you know, I think when we think about climate impacts and, you know, what's going down in BC, you know, this year, the TMX project, you know, the Trans Mountain Pipeline has been delayed by heat, fire, floods, landslides. I mean, it's almost as if Creator is helping shut down Canada. You know, and this project is overpriced unnecessarily. And multiple experts have pointed out that it cannot be built if we hope to keep temperature rise below 1.5 degrees Celsius. You know, it's time for Canada to do the only rational thing here and pause construction and initiate a formal review and reconsideration of the Trans Mountain expansion project. And then, you know, I think the thing that most disturbed me about the throne speech was that right before, you know, government went into holiday, you know, Minister O'Regan, you know, made a commitment by the Liberal government to a Just Transition Act. And, you know, Justin Trudeau left Just Transition out of his throne speech. So the obvious question is if his government is again going to drop the ball and break their promise to deliver a Just Transition Act. You know, we can't tackle the climate emergency without a plan to get off of fossil fuels and to support workers and communities, First Nations, while we do it. And dropping the Just Transition Act would be a sign that Trudeau just isn't serious about actually tackling the climate crisis.
Yeah, and I think, Clayton, you really give the strong point that, you know, the heavy lifting that's been done, but also we've got to sustain the actions that go on to keep the pressure up on Parliament overall. So thank you for that. Over to you, Robin.
Yeah, no, thanks, Livian. Thanks, thanks, Clayton. Carl, let's bring you into this. You've covered many throne speeches, and from the sounds of one of your latest articles, it sounds like this one was particularly disappointing to you. What are the key things that you had hoped to see that weren't there?
Well, I mean, I don't know whether it's fair to say one hopes for anything from this gang, but a colleague of mine who was on CBC, a press gallery colleague who was on the CBC panel on the national, Althea Raj, says, you know why they're so successful electorally, the Liberals? They're the Goldilocks party. Not too hot, not too cold. So she pointed out that after the speech, we had the Conservatives criticizing them for being the enemies of the oil and gas industry, and the Bloc saying, well, no, they're just way too weak on all that. And they say, in Althea's mind, that's just where they want to be, somewhere in the middle. But of course, another way of looking at it is when you're in the middle and you're sitting on the fence, well, sometimes that can be pretty uncomfortable sitting on the fence, you know, depending on which part of your anatomy is in contact with which part of the fence. And, you know, just to pick up on the point that Clayton was raising, I mentioned that when I wrote about it, there's nothing about just transition. That's one glaring omission in the speech, not a word. The word just transition doesn't happen. There's nothing about the great challenge of achieving an end to the use of fossil fuels in a just and a fair and a reasonable way, because it'll never happen if you can't do it that way. If you can't bring the people who earn their living from it on board, you're going to be in big trouble. Instead, they have this line after some pretty fairly pabulum weak stuff about, well, we're going to sort of meet climate objectives. It was amazing. I was shocked at how weak that part was, considering that they'd just come back. They were still unpacking their bags from Glasgow when they wrote this, when they were preparing for this throne speech. And they sort of like boy, amnesia. Like, if you forget they were even there. There's so many stuff, so much stuff that happened there didn't get anywhere even the slightest echo. And after having talked a little bit in this very weak way about how we're going to do something, for instance, climate emergencies as of the sort we're having in British Columbia, climate crises, literal crises driving people's floods and earth and similar events, they said, we're going to provide help to people. That was what they offered. They said they're going to provide. I can imagine in British Columbia, the cheers of thousands of people, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. The government says they're going to provide help. Well, we were worried they wouldn't. But, you know, another thing they say, after saying all that, they have this line very clear. While the government takes strong action to fight climate change, it will also work just as hard to get Canadian resources to new markets. Just before Glasgow, we had an expert study that said, in many ways, Canada's contribution to global warming via our exports is greater than via what we consume of and what we produce in Canada itself. And yet they're saying that they somehow are going to twist themselves in a pretzel and they're going to be all things to all people and do both of them at the same time. And not a single word about, again, the issue that came up at Glasgow, the high subsidies that we pay to the oil and gas industries. And people are wondering what we mean by that. You know, being in the oil business is considered a high-risk business, and governments for generations have given the companies a huge write-offs on their exploration activity. So they basically, they don't pay tax on the money that they invest in exploration, development, and finding new resources. And we continue to treat this industry in the same way, as a kind of high-risk industry that's necessary to coddle and foster. Not a word about that. So, I mean, I did mention it, I'll just end it there, just to switch from climate change to other issues. And again, I would echo what others have said about Indigenous people. I mean, if they were to talk about something about making reconciliation meaningful, the way to make reconciliation meaningful is to recognize there's not only the apology agenda, there's not only the symbols agenda, there's not only appointing a very good person, a decent person, to the powerless position of Governor General, a position with zero power, and is only symbolic, but there's also that what we'd have to call the hard brass tacks economic agenda. There's the natural resources agenda. There's the land and territory agenda. Not a word about that. They avoid that. They never talk about that. I mean, I was witness to the early talk, the beginning of awareness of these issues, because I'm so old, going back to the James Bay Agreement of the 1970s, to the Berger inquiry into the Mackenzie Valley later in the 1970s. And then they get to their favorite subject. They love talking about this all the time, the middle class. But, you know, even whoever they, I'm always wondering, would you, I want to ask Justin Trudeau, would you introduce me to them? Like, who does that, who gets the, who's in there? Who, how do you get a membership? Is there going to be like a middle class passport, like a vaccine passport we're going to hand out to people? We're going to get like a thumbprint or something. You're a middle class, so we love you. Middle class to do all, it's worse, probably, it's nothing. We got rid of the middle class prosperity minister because nobody could figure out what she was supposed to do. They actually gave her a real job. And the only thing they mentioned there is they're going to lower cell phone bills by the huge amount of 25%. They'll still be three times as high as everybody else, but we're going to look, and they don't say how or when or anything. They're just going to do that. And then they're going to give more support to students. What? We don't know.
That was a clip from our live politics panel, which took place last night on Thursday, December 2nd. Thanks to all who tuned in and to our wonderful guests for their insight. Stay tuned for details about January's Off the Hill panel early in the new year. Now it's time for In Case You Missed It. This week at Rabble, national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel covered two huge milestones for the 2SLGBTQ movement in Canada. First, a trans person became the leader of a major federal political party for the very first time when the Green Party of Canada appointed Dr. Amita Kuttner as its leader. Kuttner, 30, is the youngest first trans person and first person of East Asian descent to lead a national political party. Kuttner, who uses they-them pronouns, calls the appointment an honor and serious responsibility. They succeeded Annamie Paul, the first Black and Jewish leader of a major federal party, who departed as leader amid controversy and major internal strife. Wednesday was another day of hope for the 2S LGBTQ community when the House of Commons unanimously passed Bill C-4, an act that, if passed, will criminalize so-called conversion therapy in Canada. A conversion therapy ban had been set to pass through the Senate late last summer, but fell off the order paper when Parliament was dissolved for the election. The new legislation goes further than its predecessor, however, as it bans the harmful practice for children as well as adults. The unanimous vote in the House of Commons was noteworthy, as previously there were 62 votes against the legislation from Conservative Party members. For Mike Smith, a survivor of conversion therapy, the ban means others won't have to suffer like they did, Wenzel reports. Smith was subjected to efforts to change their sexual orientation and gender identity at the age of 18. And suffered horrific trauma as a result. Read more at rabble.ca. Also this week, Carl Nirenberg reports on the failing grades received by both the Trudeau and Ford governments. 2 days after the Trudeau government presented a throne speech that was disappointingly weak on plans to combat climate change, the Federal Environment Commissioner blasted Canada's emissions reduction record. On that same day, Ontario Auditor General Bonnie Lissick reported that the Doug Ford government would not achieve even a fifth of the emission reductions it had promised to achieve by 2030 if it stays on course. Crystal Krause writes about the need for the activist community to confront death and to develop new strategies for mutual and communal support for those in the movement who might be struggling with mental illness. She reflects on activists in the Toronto activist community who have died in recent years and writes about the lessons that each of them taught her. Columnist Rachel Snow wants Canadian settlers to ask themselves what they really know about First Nations who reside in Canada. The truth is that Canada does not see or understand First Nations people, Snow writes. Quote, in fact, Canada has lumped together First Nations, Inuit, and Métis into a potent mixture. Canada labels us our Indigenous peoples as if this broad group could ever be possessed by the colonial state. End quote. And that's it for this week. If you like the show, please consider subscribing. Rate, review, share it with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble, but it means so much. Follow us on social media across channels at rabble.ca. Got feedback for the show? Get in touch anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thanks to our Off the Hill hosts this week, Libby Davies and Robin Brown, guests L. Jones, Clayton Thomas Mueller, Carl Nirenberg, and MP Leah Gazan. Thanks to Carl Nirenberg for the music and his reporting, Stephen Wenzel for his reporting, and all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. I'm Brianne Doyle, and thanks so much for listening to Rabble Radio.